Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. The speaker is Katie D. from New York.
My name's Katie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Katie.
My sobriety date is April 10th of 2005. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. My home group is called Full Flight from Reality. It's a Thursday night speakers meeting in Newark, Pennsylvania. My best friend and I started it a couple years ago, and it's a good time. So what my job is to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, because that's what I was taught, and that's what I'm going to do. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a really, really good family. I have two parents that have been married to each other for 35 years. I have two younger brothers who are disgustingly normal kids. They're responsible, they do the right thing, they're comfortable with themselves. It baffled me from the time I was a kid. But, from the time I was little, man, like, I was taught, like, how I should be in life. Like, my parents taught me to, like, to help others who are less fortunate than me, to, like, give of myself and my time, to not lie, to not cheat, to not steal. It is not until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever began to practice those things, but they really tried to teach me those things. From the time I was a little kid, I was given absolutely everything that I needed, everything. And I would have probably been given everything that I've wanted, but I'm unbelievably selfish, and that's impossible. So, I tell you that all that for one reason and one reason only. It's not so you can be like, woohoo, she grew up in a good family. It's because the first time I went to rehab, I sat around in small groups, and I listened to all these people talk about these horrible things that happened to them. These things that they could use as excuses for drinking the way they drank. They got beat when they were little, they were molested, they were raised in poverty, they had all these reasons, these good reasons that they acted the way that they did, and they got to drink the way that they got to drink because these bad things happened to them. And I sat around in small groups, and I listened to these people talk about this stuff, and I wanted so badly to have something like that. I wanted so badly to have something to blame my drinking on, to blame my actions on, and I didn't. I used to want to sit there and like make crap up, so just so I could fit in, because that's what I do. And I didn't. And I discounted myself from those people in rehab, and I discounted myself from Alcoholics Anonymous really, really fast. And I thought that there was no way that I could be one of you, because that stuff didn't happen to me. So that's why I share with you that I grew up in a normal household. From the time I was a little kid, I felt different. I never felt like I was enough of anything. I never felt like I was pretty enough, smart enough, good enough at sports, good enough at art, good enough at school. I felt like no matter what I did, I couldn't measure up. And that was nobody like on the outside of me telling me that. That's just how I felt. From the time I was in elementary school, I was absolutely full of fear, and I was driven by it. I remember being a little kid in like third grade, and I would sit in class all day, and I wouldn't get up to go to the bathroom because I was petrified that I was going to have to walk in front of all those other kids, and I knew I'm so clumsy that I would trip and it would be horrible. So I would sit there all day, and I would be like dying. I had to use the bathroom so bad, but my fear stopped me. I would run home from school like a little maniac because I had to pee so bad. From the time I was little, my fear drove me, and from the time I was a little kid, my head absolutely annihilated me. I remember being in fifth grade, and I remember not being able to sleep at night. And this is what would happen. I would feel really tired, and I would go lay in my bed to fall asleep. And it was like when water beds were still really popular, so of course I had one because I had to. I had this water bed, and I would go, and I would lay down to go to sleep, and I'd feel exhausted. My body would be exhausted, and I would lay there, and as soon as I laid my head on the pillow, it felt like my head woke up for the first time that day. And this is what it would do. You're going to run into him tomorrow, and you're going to say this to him, and you're not going to wear that dorky off polyester shirt, and then you're going to run into her, and she's probably mad at you, so you should probably be rude to her. And then you're going to say this to him, and you're going to say this to her. And then you're probably going to run into her, and it would go like that all night long, and I would be like sloshing around in this waterbed, tossing and turning. It was a nightmare. And I would go wake my mom up, and I would say, "Mom, I can't sleep." And she would say, "Katie, what is wrong with you?" And I'd say, "I can't stop thinking." And she's like, "Just stop." And I was like, "No shit, I would have done that hours ago if I could." And that's how it went, man. And like 10 minutes before my alarm would go off, I would fall peacefully asleep. And then it would take like 10 alarms to wake me up. And I was just absolutely uncomfortable with who and what I was. You know, I told you guys I have these, like, extremely normal little brothers. And I watched them, and I watched them growing up, and they just had these friends, and they just had these things that they were good at. And I just never felt like I had that one thing that I was good at. I would watch them with their friends, and they looked comfortable, and they looked like they knew how to act, and they looked like they felt like they fit in. And I wanted that so bad, but I never felt like that, you know? And I don't know if I was an alcoholic from the time I was born, if I was an alcoholic whenever I was a little kid, or if all that's just normal little kid stuff. I was never another little kid, so I can't tell you. But, you know, I started drinking when I was like 14 or 15 years old, and I don't remember my first drink, but the longer I stay around Alcoholics Anonymous, it seems like the more I get to remember. But I remember what the drink did for me. I started drinking my parents' liquor. My parents had, like, my parents never drink, like, on Christmas. But for some ungodly reason, they had this exorbitant amount of Seagram 7 in this one cabinet. It is foul. It was always foul, but that's what I took to drink it. And I would drink their Seagram 7 before school, whatever. And I would fill the bottles back up with water, because that's what you do when you're 15, and you think you're, like, fooling people. But, I remember the effects that alcohol produced for me. Alcohol was the first thing that made me free. It made me comfortable with who and what I was, and it relieved me of the bondage of my head. And that is all that I ever wanted. You know, I would go to parties with kids that, like, I was friends with in high school and stuff, and I'll tell you what, if I walked into that party sober, my head absolutely annihilated me. You don't belong here. They don't like you anyways. You're a loser. You should get out of here. All of them are talking about you. They were talking about you right before you walked in the room. That's the kind of stuff my head would say. But if I drank before I went to that party, I would walk in and I felt like they were lucky to have me there. I felt like I was enough and I was the life of the party, and I was like picking out which guy was lucky to go home with me. And that's what I did, you know. And it made me free. It was absolutely my solution. You know, I hear some speakers in AA that say that, you know, they don't say that alcohol did that for them, but it is my story, and that's what alcohol did for me. I drank before I went to high school because it made high school bearable. I drank before I went to lacrosse practice. I drank before everything because it made being me okay. And, I went through high school, and I had a really, really good time, man, drinking in high school. I had so much fun. I would get in like little bits of trouble. I started to pay some consequences, but none of them were big enough consequences for me to take a look at my drinking. My parents would say, "Katie, you came home too late. You left the car lights on. You left the house lights on. You left the front door open. You left your car door open. You're grounded." I'd be like, "Whatever." Both my parents worked full-time jobs. It just meant the party was at my house. You know, I would get suspended from school for being drunk at school, but it was no big deal. I didn't want to be there anyway, man, so I felt like they were doing me a favor. And I graduated from high school, and I went to college. And I went to college not because I wanted a higher education at all. I went to college because I didn't want to get a full-time job, and that's what everybody else was doing. And I always do what everybody else is doing. For me to have an original idea is a miracle. But, I got accepted to three schools, which also was a miracle. But I got accepted to three schools, and the way that I picked the school that I went to was it was in the Pittsburgh paper as the biggest party school in the nation. And I was like, right on, man, that's where I need to be. And so I went down there, and, you know, what I do whenever I get around a new group of people is I recreate myself. I become whatever you are. I become whatever I think you want me to be. You know, Whenever I first got sober, I had this sponsor, and she would ask me funny questions like, Katie, what do you like to eat? And I would say, Karen, I like whatever you like. And she's like, no, really, what do you like to eat? And I would say, well, I don't know. Man, whenever I got sober, I had no idea what I like to eat. She would say, what kind of music do you listen to? I'd say, well, whatever you listen to. She's like, no, really, Katie. I had no idea because I spent my whole life trying to mimic you. Right after you said you liked something, I would say I liked it too. Because I thought if I could get all of you to like me, if I could get all of you to accept me, maybe I would feel okay on the inside, because I didn't. And, I went to college, and there were a bunch of hippies down there, so I became a hippie. I started wearing little bell-bottoms and Grateful Dead tie-dyes. I went to see Phil and Friends. I got introduced to the Velvet Underground and Bob Dylan, and I loved them, and I still love them. But it didn't matter, man. If you were ghetto, then I would be ghetto. I would put on my little Oakland A's hat. I would cock it to the side. I'd pull up my pant leg, and I'd listen to Tupac with you. I was whatever I thought you wanted me to be. And I went to college, and like I said, there were a bunch of hippies there, and I was like, right on, man. And I did what the hippies did and hung out with them. And I had so much fun drinking in college, too. I was no longer paying consequences with my parents. I got to drink the way I wanted to all day long. College is the first time that I remember, like, really experiencing blackouts. I remember coming to in, like, snowdrifts. I'm like, oh, my God, this isn't good. I did. Like, I had a lot of fun, and I absolutely never went to class. And I got a letter in the mail after I was there for 2 semesters, and it said that I had a 0.7 grade point average, and they put me on academic probation. And this is what happened. Whenever I'm faced with something that I might fail at, I just quit. I've done it my whole life. I am great at starting things. I will start a million projects at one time, but I couldn't finish something to save my life. When I'm faced with failure, I run, because, see, I already feel like a failure. I don't need you to tell me that I failed. So I just quit, and I went back to live at my parents' house. And look, y'all, I have these two parents that love me more than anything in the world. And if somebody could have been loved sober, they would have loved me sober, but they couldn't. And if there was an imaginary line to have been crossed in my alcoholism, from it being a party to the point of no return, this is whenever I believe I took a step across that imaginary line. I went back to my parents' house, and I was no longer drinking because it was fun. I was no longer drinking because it was a party or because I was hanging out with my friends. I was drinking to satisfy a mental obsession that was beyond my control. I was drinking because whenever I would wake up in the morning, my head would absolutely annihilate me until I took a drink. And, whenever I would wake up in the morning, the pain of the past hurt so bad. The things that I had to do to get a drink would just attack me. And until I took another drink, I wouldn't shut my head up. And this is what would happen, man. My parents they still kind of trusted me at this point, and they would leave their checkbook at the house. And I would take their checks, and I would write their checks out until they would write checks out to pay their bills, and their checks would bounce. My one little brother, I told you guys, is like disgustingly responsible, and he had saved up all of his own money to put himself through college. And I borrowed his ATM card one day, and I had every intention on just borrowing $40. And I drained his account, and it was all the money he had saved up to go to college. And this is what would happen. My parents would say, Katie, you need to get help, or you need to get the hell out of our house. And I would say, see you later. And I would go stay with these people that I thought were much worse off than me. They smelled worse than me. They were doing worse things than me. They showered less often than me. And frankly, at that point, I thought they were like lower companionship. And I would go stay at their houses, and I would last like 2 or 3 days, and I would steal their DVDs, and I would sell them, and I would steal their guns, and I would sell them. And they would say, Katie, what the hell is wrong with you? You got to get out of here. And this is what I would do. I would call my mom, and I would say, Mom, how could you do this to me? I am your only daughter. You are letting me live on the streets with these horrible people. You know what, Mom? I'm going to die, and it's going to be all your fault. And she would say, Katie, I am so sorry. Please come home. And I would say, okay. And I'd go home. Eventually, what ended up happening is I got backed into a corner to go to my first rehab. I stole a car and a credit card. Through a series of events, I got backed into a corner. And, you know, whenever I went to rehab, it was that or jail. I'll always pick rehab with those options. I don't jail well. I went to rehab, man, and I had absolutely no desire to stop drinking, not even a little itty-bitty bit, nothing. And I went to rehab really because I wanted to stay out of jail. I'm like, I thought it was pretty cool, like, I get to put some weight on and hang out for 28 days and not be sick from detoxing, so that was all right. And, I got to tell you guys, I was really, really gorgeous when I went to my first rehab. I weighed 78 pounds. My size zero pants were hanging off of me. My skin was like a color between yellow and gray. It looked like I had two black eyes, like I had been punched, but I hadn't. They were just that way. My hair was matted to my head, and my mom told me that all she wanted for Mother's Day was for me to please take a shower because I refused to shower. But I thought I was, like, really gorgeous. And I went to rehab, and this is what I do whenever I go to rehab. I find the sickest, cutest boy I can find, and I make him my boyfriend. And because he's going to make me feel better for those 28 days while I'm in there. And then he'll start to get on my nerves, and then it'll be over. Or I'll start to get on his. One of those two are bound to happen. But I went to rehab, and that's exactly what I did. I listened to nothing that those people told me. They suggested a sponsor. I saw that they had God written on the wall. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. The steps were not for me. They were for those people with the childhood problems. None of that stuff applied to me. Because, see, I always thought that I was going to grow out of it. I always thought that someday, that all kids did this, and someday I was just going to come out of it smelling like a rose. And all that stuff was just going to come to me, the house, the car, the husband, the college education, with no work on my part, and I was just going to grow out of it, and it was going to be all right. And that's really, truly what I thought. But I went to rehab, I listened to nothing anybody told me, and I found two sick, cute boys, and I made them both my boyfriends. And I left rehab early because I was in my aunt's wedding, and it was imperative for me to be there because the wedding just wouldn't have gone right. And so I took my little chip, and I went on my way. And I drank the day I got out of rehab. And what happens to me whenever I drink is I don't drink like a lady and then go to work the next day and do responsible things. I have an allergy to alcohol. I am also allergic to cats. My mother is not allergic to cats. She gets around cats, nothing happens. I get around cats, I break out in hives, I start sneezing, my eyes get itchy, my throat starts to close up, it's horrible. Much like that, I have an allergy to alcohol. My mother, not allergic to alcohol. She drinks like a half a glass of wine, lands up in bed next to my father, whom she's been married to for 35 years. She goes to work the next day. I take a drink, and nothing like that happens. I disappear for 2 weeks. I come out of a blackout the next day looking for my car. I start shooting drugs intravenously in my arm, who knows? Or I roll over and wake up the next day, and I'm like, oh my God, it's so nice to meet you. That happens. Any of those things happen, but me waking up and going to work does not happen. And once I start drinking, I can't stop until something else stops me. And that's exactly what happened. I started drinking again, and all bets were off, and I started stealing from the people that I love the most and hurting the people that I love the most, because that's what I do. Look, I'm a horrible criminal, and I'm a coward. So I will hurt first and the most the people that I hold right here, the people that I love the very most, and that's exactly what I did. And around this time, my mom and I decided that it was a really good idea for me to move to the sunny state of Florida for the second time, because it was the city of Pittsburgh that was the problem. It was the projects in Pittsburgh that were the problem. It was my boyfriend in Pittsburgh that was the problem. It was my friends in Pittsburgh that was the problem. And if I would just get away from all those things, then I would be okay. So I moved to the sunny state of Florida for the second time. It didn't work the first time, but this time it was going to work. And I moved down there, and I stayed with my aunt and uncle down there. I stayed sober for 3 days when I got there. Before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and doing your steps, sobriety and happiness never went together for me. Sobriety was painful. It sucked. My skin felt too tight. I hated who I was. And I couldn't, like, thinking about living that normal 9-to-5 life made me want to commit suicide. And, you know, I sat there for 3 days sober in Florida feeling just like that. And I called my mom and I was like, Mom, I friggin' hate this place. I hate the sun. I wish it would rain. I hate the palm trees. They're making me sick. The old people can't drive. They're making right-hand turns from the left-hand lane. You gotta get me out of here. And she said, Katie, I don't know what's wrong with you. You are in the most beautiful place on earth. Why can't you be happy? And the most honest thing that I could tell her is, Mom, I don't know. And I stayed down there, and before you know it, I started doing what I always do. I started drinking like a pig and stealing from my family. And I'll tell you what, man, that time in Florida became very important to me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because whenever I got here, I really, truly didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to be a junkie. I wanted to be a dope fiend. I wanted to be an addict. I wanted to be any of those things because, frankly, they just sounded cooler than being a drunk. And, you know, the time in Florida became very, very important to me because I drank like a pig. I drank like until I blacked out. None of those other substances really came into play until much, much later, and I was still having the exact same problems. I was still paying the exact same consequences. And, you know, I remembered something kind of recently from my time in Florida, and I don't know if this will make any sense to you, but it made a lot of sense to me whenever I remembered it. Whenever I was drinking, I used to tell myself these lies so I could make the actions that I was taking and me drinking the way that I was okay. You know, I lived with my aunt down there. And she was like so very good, and I used to call her Mother Teresa, and it like disgusted me, and I'd be like, well, if Mother Teresa wasn't constantly on my back, I wouldn't have to drink this way. She didn't call and report to my mom every 20 minutes about every move I was making. I wouldn't have to drink like this. And, you know, I used to tell myself these lies over and over and over again, so I would make inside of me what I was doing was okay. And I remember in Florida telling myself those lies and no longer being able to convince myself of that. I remember, like, somewhere deep down inside of me, there being, like, a little nagging that, like, I knew that no matter how many excuses I made, that I knew that I was, that what I was doing wasn't okay. I knew I was taught differently than this. And I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but it was like a start of my conscience was starting to show up out of nowhere or something, I don't know. But that just dawned on me recently. It lasted in Florida for like 9 months or something, and until my dad came to pick me up. And I went back to Pittsburgh. When I went back to Pittsburgh, my very favorite aunt in the world was having this little baby. She was in the hospital having this little baby. And I'll tell you guys what, no matter what I was doing or how much I was drinking or how much I hated myself, I always wanted to be a part of my family. I wanted nothing more than to be a part of my family. And throughout my drinking, I had really, really good intentions. I wanted to show up for Christmas dinner. I wanted to show up for Christmas mass with my mom. I wanted nothing more than my dad to say, Katie, I'm proud of you. And I used to ask my mom, why doesn't Dad say he's proud of me? And she'd say, Katie, because you do nothing to be proud of. And I was like, ooh. But, you know, I did have good intentions to show up for my family. I did inside want to do that, you know. And I went that day to show up for my aunt in the hospital. But before I could show up for my family anymore, I had to drink up the courage because I couldn't face them sober. Because one of two things would happen if I would face them sober. First of all, if I would face them sober, I would be so uncomfortable and my skin would crawl and I'd have to get out of there within 5 minutes because I couldn't stand it. Or one of them was bound to look me in the eyes, and what would happen is they would look me in the eyes, my heart would fall into my stomach because I thought they could see the disgusting, rotten person that I was on the inside. I thought they could see all the money that I had stolen from them, all the pain that I caused them, all the bad things that I had ever done. So I had to go drink up the courage to face them. And that's exactly what I went to do. I was in this part of town that I didn't fit in so well. I'll give you a little disclaimer. I have been arrested before. No big deal. You give me ARD classes that I'm never going to take, a probation officer that I'm never going to call, a license that I'm never going to surrender, and a fine that I'm never going to pay, and right on, man, I'm going to keep on drinking. But this day was a little bit different. I was sitting on the side of this road of this town that I didn't really fit in so well. And I was so physically ill from withdrawing from alcohol. And my buddy was walking back to the car with our solution. task force pulled up. And whenever I got full of fear, and whenever I get full of fear, still to this day, my immediate reaction is to just run. I'm almost 5 years sober, and my immediate reaction today, whenever I get full of fear, is I want to run. And I have a sponsor now who yells at me, so I don't do that. But you know, that day I didn't have one, and so I ran. The task force officer at this point was out of his vehicle. Apparently, I almost ran him over. I do not remember that, but I'm sure the gentleman's telling the truth. So I just took off, man. I just had this car that looked kind of like a little go-kart. It did not go very fast. I looked in my rearview mirror like 500 feet later, and he was right behind me. I mean, this dude had to get off the ground, into his car, turn his car around, and he was right behind me. Mind you, I was running from the cops in second gear going like 40 miles per hour. The whole thing was pitiful. But I looked in my rearview mirror and he was right behind me, and about a mile later I pulled over. And I'll tell you what, man, I don't know if that's the moment I surrendered. I don't know what happened. But that day felt like the worst day of my whole entire life. And I'll tell you what I believe today. I believe today that day that the hand of God reached down into the ghetto and it pulled me out. Because, see, I wasn't getting sober. I wasn't getting a relationship with God. I grew up Catholic, and I stopped going to CCD in the eighth grade, and I thought God and I kindly walked our separate ways, and he could go do his God thing, and I was going to go do my thing. And the motto that I lived by was, you know what, I already screwed my life up enough. I'm already going to hell, so I might as well have a good time on the way there. And that's how I lived my life. And I wanted nothing to do with God, and I surrendered to that way of life. I surrendered to the way of life on the streets, and I really, truly just wanted to die. I remember begging God to just kill me because I thought it would save myself and everybody I loved pain. I thought I would be doing the world a favor by being dead. And when I look back today, I believe that I was touched by the grace of God that day. And because none of my ideas were getting me to Alcoholics Anonymous or getting me sober. Anyway, the kind officer got his gun out and got me out of the vehicle after I pulled over. He threw me in some guy's front yard, and I was laying there with handcuffs on, and the guy was mowing his grass, and he mowed his grass right around me like it happened every day. They took me to jail, and they made this poor female officer come pick me up, and I probably owe her amends. I harassed the crap out of her on the way to the Pittsburgh City Prison. I was like, are you really taking me to jail? She's like, yeah, shut up. I'm like, can I have a cigarette? She's like, no, shut up. I'm like, my uncle's a probation officer. She's like, no, shut up. This poor lady. But I got to jail, and I was scared to death, man. Like, I was scared to death. And as soon as I got there and was allowed to make a phone call, I called my dad. My dad's this short, little, fat Italian man that looks kind of like a meatball with arms. I love my dad. He is my favorite person on earth. No matter how bad my drinking got, no matter how bad it got, my dad was always the one to bail me out. My dad was the one whenever I was carrying the TV out of the back of the house to pawn. He was the one handing me $5 saying, Katie, please just eat. Don't tell your mother I gave you money. Please just eat. That's my dad. So as soon as I got to make a phone call, of course I'm going to call him. So I called my dad and I was like, hey, Dad, it's Katie. I'm in jail. And he's like, I know you ran from the cops in my vehicle because I had nothing. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, so, like, are you going to come get me or what? And he was like, no, dude. He was like, I'm not going to come get you. He's like, you know what, Kate? I'm going to be able to sleep tonight because I know you're not killing yourself. What? And I was like, oh, shit. So I called him back because I thought he made a mistake. And I was like, Dad, I don't think you understand, man. They're going to take me upstairs with the criminals. And he said, Katie, I don't think you understand. You are a criminal. Click. And I was like, oh, shit. So I was like, I guess it looks like I'm going upstairs. And they took me upstairs, and I was really, really scared. Any girl that looked anything like me had a black eye and a fat lip, and I was like, oh, this is not going to be good for me. They put me in a cell with another lady that was detoxing, and this lady stood about this high, and she had hair down to here, and she didn't have one tooth in her mouth, and she had so many scabs on her body, she looked like she had scales. And she had told me that she had been doing the things that I had been doing for 45 years. And I'll tell you what, whenever I looked into this lady's eyes, I don't know what happened, but I knew that I was going to land up just like her. I knew that I wasn't going to be one of the lucky ones that got to die, and I was going to land up just like her. Mm. And I just had a moment, just a moment, where my ego was smashed. Trust me, it has come back. But just in that moment, man, my ego was smashed, and something inside of me changed. And, you know, I was willing to do stuff at that point that I was never in my life willing to do before. And I stayed there for a couple of days until eventually my parents came to bail me out. And when I got back to their house, I went up to lay in my bed at their house to feel sorry for myself, because, man, I knew the Pittsburgh police were out to get me, and it wasn't fair and for me. And, because that's how I roll. And, I went up there to feel bad for myself, and I was laying up there, and, my dad came up, and like I told you, my dad is this little teeny Italian man, and I'm 28 years old, and I've never seen my father cry. And like I told you, my mother has been married to him for 35 years, and she told me that the only time she's ever seen my father cry is the day that I was born. And my dad came up, and he sat on my bed, and he started to cry. And he said, "Katie, I want you to know that whenever you're doing this, you're not just killing you, but you're killing me." And I'll tell you what, my whole entire life, I always thought, just leave me alone. Just mind your own freaking business. Go live your little 9-to-5 life. I'm not hurting you. I'm not affecting you. I don't know why you're always in my business. Just go do what you got to do and leave me alone. And I'll tell you what, man, my dad smashed that for me that day. I voluntarily went to inpatient rehab 10 days later. I never voluntarily go to inpatient rehab, but I did 10 days later, and I stayed there for 28 days, and I would never tell you that my motives were pure as the driven snow, or I was, like, pumped to come to AA and, like, get a sponsor and find God, because I wasn't. But something inside me had changed. They told me that I needed to go to a recovery house, and I told them that I would go to a recovery house if it was in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, or New York City, because I'm an artist and I need to be around culture. And they kindly told me that obviously my ideas haven't been so good up until now, being as though I was in jail and then rehab, so how about I listen to somebody else for a change? And I did, and they sent me to York, Pennsylvania. We have the Police Heritage Museum there. I went there, and they dropped me off at this recovery house, and I was so scared. I walked into this recovery house, and there was some chick sitting in the corner with toilet paper wrapped around her head, talking on the phone. She just gave me the nod. I was like, okay. Then some other girl came down from upstairs and got a box of crackers out of the kitchen and took it back upstairs, but stopped on the stairs and was like, "Don't freaking rat me out." I'm like, "So what? I don't even know the rules. I've been here 5 minutes." And then the house president came home, pointed at me and said, "This one's definitely getting drunk." And I was like, "Oh my God." You know, I came down from rehab with this other little girl, and she said to me, "Katie, there's an AA meeting around the corner in an hour. How about we go?" And like anything good that has happened to me in my sobriety, it was not my idea. And I said, okay, and I went with her. And it's funny who God has used in my life, because I went to this meeting, and this kid that I was checking out in rehab that I thought was pretty cute was in the meeting. And he raised his hand and he had shared that he did a fourth and a fifth step in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had a sponsor here. And I knew, man, that he was just as miserable as I was in rehab 2 weeks ago, because I was watching him. Trust me. I listened to what he had to say, and I talked to him after the meeting, and he told me that his sponsor had a girlfriend who was also a member of AA, and he gave me her telephone number. And a couple days later, I called her, and she came and picked me up for a meeting. And ever since I met the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have absolutely been taken by you. I was amazed by her. I was absolutely amazed by her. See, I had never been to AA before, ever. The closest I've ever got to one of your meetings is I bought drugs in your parking lot. And I've never, ever been in here before. But I'll tell you this, I spent my whole entire life walking around this earth feeling completely alone. And the day that her and I had that first conversation, I no longer felt like that. You know, I have been approached my whole entire life by people in positions of authority over me to get sober. I have been approached by my parents, by my brothers, by parole officers, by probation officers, by psychiatrists, by psychologists. You know, my aunt jacked me up against the wall once because I stole her pennies. She told me I had to get sober. But I have never been approached on an eye-to-eye equal level like I was by the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never once did she tell me that I had to do anything here, or that that because I met with her once and took her time, that anything was a requirement of me. She made Alcoholics Anonymous so attractive. She said to me, "Katie, look, this is where I've come from, this is what I've done, and this is where I'm at today. And if you want that, you always have a seat in my car, and you're welcome to come along. And if you don't, like, right on, man, go do what you got to do." And she made Alcoholics Anonymous attractive for me. And, you know, I met with her that once, and she told me that her whole life she had been a chameleon. And I never knew that anybody else did that. I was amazed by the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, she told me to go home and read the doctor's opinion, and I did that. I went home and I read the doctor's opinion, and I read it like 4 times because I didn't understand any of the words, and I'm insanely neurotic, and I'm like altruistic. What does this mean? She's going to ask me questions. I have to know things. And I met with her, and she wanted to hear absolutely nothing that I had to say at all. You know, we sat down and we went through the first 3 steps. When we went through the first 3 steps in like 20 minutes, and I'll tell you what I believe today, and take it for what it is. I'm like only 4 and 5 years sober, but I believe for me that the first 3 steps were in place whenever I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that the first 3 steps are God's job; they're not my job. And I'll tell you why I believe this, because there's a lot of recovery houses in York, man, like 86, and I have had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of girls, and I have tried with every ounce of my will to give them steps 1, 2, and 3. I have tried to share my experience. I've tried to share your experience. I've tried to read them out of the book page by page. I've tried to read them out of the 12 and 12. I've tried to make shit up. And nothing that I do is powerful enough to make steps 1, 2, and 3 occur in another human being. God is the only thing that is that powerful. And that's what I believe, so whatever. But, you know, We sat down and talked about those steps, and the step that I probably look like I knew I was powerless for like a long time before I stopped drinking. I knew that I didn't have a choice, and as far as my life being unmanageable, like any idiot could tell my life was unmanageable. I never had anything. I wasn't a drunk that came into AA and lost the house with the white picket fence, the dog, the husband, the kids. I went from high school to homeless. I never had anything. So any idiot could tell my life was unmanageable. You know, but the people in AA talked to me about the unmanageability on the inside. She talked to me about being absolutely driven by my emotion and my fear and my thinking. I never knew what that was, you know? And the step that I probably had the biggest problem with was step 3. Because look, y'all, like, when I got sober, I thought God hated me and I hated him. And I read it on the wall and I thought I knew what it was all about. And I was like, look, Karen, like, there is no way that I am turning my will and my legs over this bearded man in the sky that zaps me with lightning bolts. Like, I am not doing it. She made it really easy for me. She said, you know what, Katie, all you need at this point is to make a decision to go on with the rest of the steps and to start doing in your heart what you know to be right and to stop doing what you know to be wrong. And I could do that. And from there, my idea of God has grown and changed so much, and I hope it grows and changes more. You know, I look back on my drinking now, and I think about all those times that I thought God wasn't helping me, that God hated me, and that I was garbage, and he just left me out there to die. And I look back now, and I laugh, because, man, like, he was trying to help me. I would go see psychiatrists, and they'd say, "Katie, you are nuts, but we can't help you. Go to AA." And I would never go back and see them again. I would run into people on and off in different places that I used to drink with, and they would be like, "I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's my phone number," and I was throwing them away. See, the problem for me never was that God wasn't willing to help. The problem for me was that I was not willing to accept his grace. I was throwing it away. And anyway, I wrote my first inventory, My first inventory was, when I read it with my sponsor, it was a really cool experience. That is probably to date the coolest experience that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, whenever I came in here, like, I really liked your meetings. I really liked all you guys. I liked to watch how you interacted with each other. I thought you hugged a little too much. It wigged me out, but I could get over myself. But I really thought it was cool. But I always felt like I was behind this piece of glass. I always felt like I was watching you all from behind this piece of glass. Like, I was just a little bit separated from you guys. And I just didn't share in something you guys had. And the day that I read my first inventory with my sponsor, that piece of glass came down when I stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I felt like I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I was really excited to be here. My first inventory, I shared all those things that I had never shared with another human being, and it absolutely de-uniqued me. From that moment on, I never felt like I was walking around this earth alone again. And I was like a year and a half sober, and I thought like super crazy, like I could not stop thinking. And my sponsor that I have now had me write inventory again. And a year and a half sober, I went down to read my inventory with her, and I got to see Katie for exactly what kind of human being I was. I got to see what kind of friend I was, what kind of daughter I was, what kind of employee I was. At a year and a half sober, I thought I should be well. I wasn't. I have never wanted to do step 6 and 7 so bad before in my life. The first time I did step 6 and 7 after I wrote that first inventory, I went up to my little room in the recovery house. I read them out of the book. I was like, cool. I sat there and thought about myself for 45 minutes. I got down on my knees. I said the prayer. I went outside. I said the prayer again because I thought I was closer to God there. And I was like, word, I'm going to write my 8-step list. But, after I wrote that inventory, at a year and a half sober, I have never so badly wanted for God to change me. All throughout my sobriety thus far, I have really tried to think my way into better living. I have tried to fix myself and make myself act right. And I'll tell you what, man, I don't have the power, but God does. After I wrote that inventory, my sponsor told me to go read step 6 and 7 out of the 12 and 12. And I read that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I was like, oh, geezy, I should have paid more attention to that the first time around. But I want so badly for God to change me. Mind you, like, I'm not the girl that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, nor am I anywhere near perfect. I don't even touch perfect with my little finger. But I don't have the power it takes to change me, nor does my thinking, And I couldn't think my way out of a cardboard box, so I have to trust for God to change me. Mind you, that doesn't give me the right to walk around Alcoholics Anonymous and act like a douchebag and just say, God hasn't removed it yet. That is not what step 6 and 7 gives me. This step 6 and 7, I am to say that prayer and trust that God will remove it and do my best to act as if he already has. And they're probably my favorite steps now. I made my first 8-step list, and I went back to Pittsburgh, and I went to make amends to my parents, my mom and my dad, and they were like, sweet, Kate, just stay sober, whatever. And I went to make amends to my youngest brother, and he was like, all I wanted was a sister. I had my sister back. And I was like, awesome. And so I was doing so well, I thought I would go make amends to my other brother, the one that I stole all the money from. And I said what I was directed to say, and I said, Derek, is there any way that I've harmed you that I'm unaware of? And he said, frankly, Katie, I think that you're full of shit. He said, you've been full of shit since I've known you, that since I was 2. And I can't believe a word that you're going to say, He's like, you've lied to me your whole entire life. He's like, you're going to actually have to show me that you're doing something different. And in the past 4 years, I've tried my best to do that. I don't call my brother and talk about myself. I don't call him and ask him for money. When he calls, I have paid him off, but when he calls and asks me for money, I send it without question. When he calls me at 3 o'clock in the morning, I answer his phone call, and I do the best to be the sister that I believe that God wants me to be. And by no means is our relationship my idea of the relationship we should have. But by all means, it's God's. And you know, like, about 2 years ago, this kid that I was dating and I broke up, and my little brother drove from Pittsburgh to Harrisburg to have dinner with his big sister because he knew I was upset. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for that relationship. You know, whenever I first got sober, I equated with making amends to people with owing them money. I don't know why. But I had this little grandma, man, and I never stole any money from her, so I didn't really think I owed her amends. And she kept getting sick. And I started getting really afraid that she was going to pass away, and I did, in fact, owe her amends. And I talked to my sponsor a lot about it, and we decided that I did, in fact, harm her, and I had to go back and make amends to her. So I drove back from York to Pittsburgh, and the whole way, my thinking is always so wrong. I still, today, I don't know why I listen to it sometimes, but I do. The whole way back, I'm like, dude, this is going to be so easy. She's 78. I'm obviously her favorite grandkid. Like, what's she going to say? This is going to be so easy. So I drove the whole way back thinking that. I walked into her house, and we sat down, and I said, Grandma, is there any way that I harmed you that I'm unaware of? And she said, Katie, I will tell you exactly how you harmed me. And for the next 45 minutes, that 78-year-old lady let me have it, boy. She told me the exact nature of my wrong. I was like, oh, my God. But I walked away from that amends with one of the biggest gifts that I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked away from that amends with a knowing in my heart that I did not drink my way into Alcoholics Anonymous, that I do not deserve to sit here, and that I did not earn my seat here. I believe that I get to sit in Alcoholics Anonymous because women of faith prayed for me. Women like my grandmother and women like my mother. Women who believed in a God their whole entire life whenever I was too much of a coward to do it myself. That's why I believe I get to sit in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, that's probably one of the coolest gifts that I've been given. Well, about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, my grandma got very sick, and my mom told me that hospice had been called in, and that I needed to drive back, and I needed to say goodbye to her. And that's what I did. I drove back to Pittsburgh, and I went to say goodbye to her. And she was laying in her living room, and she couldn't talk, and she couldn't open her eyes, and she couldn't drink water on her own anymore. And I'm not really sure if she even really knew that I was in the room, but Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the opportunity to sit by her bed and hold her hand. And I held my grandma's hand, and I told her that she was my hero. And I thanked her for praying for me. And I thanked her for saving my life. And I got to tell her that her prayers to her God worked. And that's probably one of the coolest things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. You know, she passed away a couple weeks later, and I got to go to the funeral as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't embarrass my family, and I got to be there for my mom, who lost her mother, and my aunts, who lost their mother, and it was a pretty cool experience. And you know what? After my grandma died, I was pretty mad at God for a really long time, and I was like, why would he take her from me? And my mom, so principled, and I called her one day, and I was like, you know what? Like, she was supposed to be at my wedding, man. Like, this isn't fair. And my mom said, Katie, how self-centered are you? She said, your grandmother was so sick. She would have never wanted to live that quality of life that she was living. And maybe, just maybe, it was okay for her to go now because she knew you were okay. Her work here was done. And I was like, well, great, I can't be mad at God anymore, thanks. I've got to make some pretty cool amends, and I have a lot of amends that I still have to make. I have a lot of financial amends that I still have to make. I stole a lot of money from a lot of people, which is a bummer now. I have some people that don't want to hear my amends. I have one guy in Pittsburgh that I was, like, emailing, like, obsessively, and my sponsor was like, please stop stalking him. Like, he doesn't want anything to do with you. And I was like, oh, okay. But, amends have been a pretty cool thing for me. You know, as far as steps 10, 11, and 12, I don't practice the 10 steps so good, to be honest with you. This is what I do. I do, like, three of the four parts, and then I call my sponsor, and I'm like, this stupid thing doesn't work. And she's like, did you pray, or did you go help someone? And I'm like, well, no, I'm calling you. And And that's why it doesn't work, because I do three of the four parts. Whatever I do for all four of the parts, man, it works really well. But, you know, I've had to write a lot of inventories, and I think it's a direct result of practicing a hobbable 10 step. Just so you know. As far as prayer and meditation, I've prayed on my knees since I was in rehab. This chick was who was my roommate in rehab prayed on her knees, and she told me one night to pray on my knees, and she was bigger than me, so I started doing it because I was scared of her. And I prayed on my knees ever since, and it's what works, and I just don't change it really. And as far as meditation, I was pretty lucky. I got brought up in AA by a bunch of crazy old timers, man, who were involved in all kinds of crazy meditation. And they meditated the bells, they did all kinds of stuff. I went on spiritual retreats with them, and all of it was really, really good experience. And all of it I really liked, but at the end of the day, what I practice every day is what's written on pages 86 to 88 in our big book. I read it in the morning, and I review my day every night, and it works. I don't know. And as far as helping others, like I said, I've had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of girls, and some days it really does feel like a gift. It really, truly does. I can feel that gratitude in my heart. And some days, man, when my phone rings, I'm like, what could she want now? You've got to be kidding me. And, you know, I'll call my sponsor and I'll start complaining about it, and she'll kindly remind me that I am absolutely living on borrowed time, that I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I better pick up that phone because somebody picked it up for me. And she reminds me really, really quick that without AA and without giving of my life to others, that I have no life. As far as practicing these principles and all my affairs, my first year of sobriety, like, I thought I was really, really good at that. I'm like, what are these old people talking about? This is so easy. After I turned a year sober, I don't know what happened, but I realized that I absolutely sucked at it. I had to learn how to do everything. I lived like an animal from the time I was like 15 years old. I didn't know how to pay bills on time. I didn't know how to be a friend. My idea of being a friend was to take absolutely everything that you have until you have nothing left to give me, and then find a new friend. And I had to be taught how to do all those things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am so grateful to my sponsor for teaching me how to do those things. And, you know, I do the best that I can, and, you know, I learn a lot from my mistakes, really. You know, I would never get up here and tell you that, like, since I got sober, my whole life has been some beautiful gold paper of the happy destiny, because I would be lying to you if I told you that. My crazy things have happened in my sobriety. My house got robbed. My car got robbed. The store I'm a manager in got robbed. I'm like the robbery magnet. I was telling my friend on the way up here. I've had two grandmothers die within the past 2 years. I've broken up with lots of guys, which was my own fault. But I have had crazy things happen to me. Friends and I have gotten in fights. But this is the deal, man. Alcoholics Anonymous has not given me a perfect life. It has given me a choice. I could sit there and I could stomp my feet and I can be in self-pity and say, look how the world treats me wrongly. Poor, poor Katie. And you know what, man? Sometimes I like to do that. It gets painful after like 10 minutes of it, but sometimes I like to do it. Or I could call my sponsor and pick up the spiritual kit of tools that have been laid at my feet, and do my best to walk through whatever I'm going through with dignity and grace, and hold my head high and look for the beauty in it. And whenever I do that, I see lessons in every area of my life, whenever I'm able to do that. You know, I have everything material in my life that I've ever wanted. Before I got sober, I never had an apartment. I never had a cell phone. I never had anything. I have all that stuff. Next December, I'll graduate from college, and next January I plan on moving up to New York City. Like, my dreams are coming true here. I've had dreams come true for me that I've had since I was 2 years old, and they've come true for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's pretty amazing. You know, but probably what's the most profound thing today is I no longer possess that self-hate that I've harbored my whole entire life. I no longer hate myself whenever I look in the mirror. And probably the thing that's the coolest is that I have a relationship with God. And that was the last thing on earth I ever wanted. And I'll tell you one last story and I'll shut up because I talk a whole lot. But 2.5 years ago, my parents were in a horrible car accident. A car hit them head on and the car caught fire. And my parents and my youngest brother were trapped in the car. And the guy who was behind them pulled over and got my parents and my youngest brother out of the car. And they were took to the hospital, and my aunt called me, and she said, "Katie, your parents are in surgery. We don't know what's going to happen, but they were in a really bad car accident." And I said, "All right, Aunt Pam, I'll be right home." And she was like, "No, you need to stay where you're at. I don't think that you're going to do anything that the doctors at Allegheny General Hospital don't already know about. So why don't you just stay where you're at?" And that's exactly what I did. And whenever it was appropriate for me to go home to be a service to my family, that's exactly what I did. And my mom had broken both of her wrists, and she had metal plates put in both of her wrists, and she had cast up to here. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the opportunity to feed my mother when she could not feed herself. My dad had some weird break in his leg where his bone was sticking out, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the opportunity to help my dad walk when all he could do on his own was crawl. AA has given me the opportunity to show my parents just this much of the unconditional love that they have been giving me my whole entire life. So thank you very much for having me.